1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rockers. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, we'll go a few rounds with Sammy Hagar on the 35th anniversary of his breakthrough album, Standing Hampton.
I don't know, I've kind of been a fighter kind of guy in my life as well. You know, it's coming from nothing and poor family and so forth. I kind of related to fighting for anything you needed, you know. If it were a confrontation man to man, well, you duked it out, you know. If it were a mental combat, well, you tried to outsmart the guy and so forth. And in my case now, you try to outsing the competition and do a better show than the competition. You know, so it's still the same game to me. It just, I don't get hit as much. Hey, this is Sammy Hagar doing In the Studio with the best of Sammy Hagar. Dig it.
From his hometown of Fontana, California, the young Sammy Hagar relocated to Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area. It was there around 1972 that the aspiring singer first saw a neighbor of his, guitarist Ronnie Montrose, playing in the Edgar Winter Group at the peak of their popularity. That would be the opening bell in a long series of bouts with fame and fortune for the feisty, driven, gregarious Sammy Hagar, who grew up as a fighter, quite literally.
My father was a professional fighter. He was bantamweight. He was, top contender, fought for the titles quite a few times, but he fought a great fighter, one of the most famous fighters in history, Manuel Ortiz. He fought him 7 times, and if it wasn't for Manuel Ortiz, my dad would have obviously been bantamweight champ. But so he always said, well, my son's going to be bantamweight. It's kind of like a Ray Mancini kind of a deal. You know, Ray's father always, you know, wanted his son to be champ, and Ray wanted to do that for his father, and he did it. I never did, because I, as soon as I got a car when I turned 16, I kind of said, see you, Dad, and I was out the door starting, you know, to party and stuff. But I wanted to be a fighter for a long time, and I grew up with boxing. It's still my favorite sport. I watch it constantly. I still train once in a while like a fighter. I'm mainly into mountain biking and stuff now, but there was a time before I was into mountain biking where I used to work out with heavy bag and speed bag and jump rope and jog. So, I don't know, I've kind of been a fighter kind of guy in my life as well. You know, it's coming from nothing and poor family and so forth. I kind of related to fighting for anything you needed, you know. If it were confrontation man to man, well, you duked it out, you know. If we're a mental combat, well, you try to outsmart the guy and so forth. And in my case now, you try to outsing the competition and do a better show than the competition, you know. So it's still the same game to me. It just I don't get hit as much.
That's Sammy Hagar singing Rock Candy, one of 4 songs he wrote and sang for that first classic Montrose album in 1973. Clearly, Sammy is proud of his father's stature in the senior Hagar's professional boxing career, learning never to quit with your eyes on the prize. But Sammy Hagar watched and learned that substance abuse could defeat his dad in a way no person ever could.
Most definitely. You know, when you see your father at 53, you know, drink himself to death in a park, you know, he died under a park bench, man. I'm not joking. And it's really, you know, like I said, first thing I said, is that's never going to happen to me. I mean, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I see it now. I see where certain things lead you. And, you know, and I have, I've used drugs in my life lightly, casually, you know, on a party level and sociable level, you might say, you know, just to hang in there with the pals and see what it's all about and all that. And, you know, if that's your kind of recreation, entertainment, you know, just, you got to just know what you're really into here. And when it becomes more than recreation, then you got problems, and big problems, problems that can kill you, problems that can kill other people, problems that can just take you right down, and that's what alcohol or any of those things do. And if you can't keep them under control, if you're one of those kind of people that can't keep them under control, I mean, you just can't do them. I know plenty of people like that. They can't take one drink. If they take one drink, they got to keep drinking until they pass out or until they do something so stupid someone knocks them out. And same with drugs. There's some people they just can't stop. And if you're that kind of person, man, don't even start, because it's a one-way street. And I've seen where it leads with friends and with my own father. And yeah, I mean, that's easy. A blind man could have seen that. You know, what I saw, you know, made it real easy for me, my whole family.
With his first two rounds with Montrose, things soured quickly between Sammy Hagar and the group's more experienced namesake, Ronnie Montrose. After singing on their second album, Sammy had to decide what to do next.
When I left Montrose, I mean, no question, I wanted to go out and put together a band of friends, because the last year in that band was so bitter. I said, I'll never play with guys I don't like again. You know, so I just got the best players that were friends that I knew, which was Bill Church. I took him from Montrose, and I got Denny Carmassi's little brother, because Denny stayed with Ronnie, and Denny later on came to my band again after that. We just went out and played trio, then we added a couple of new players, and I just look around for different people. Every time I found a guy I liked, you know, as a person that was a good player, I'd say, hey, you want to join my band? It was like, well, you know, do you need another guitar player? No, but join it anyway. You know, it's like I was really into having a bunch of buddies out there playing music on stage, because then when you walked out on stage, the vibe was so good. That's how I made it as a solo artist. It wasn't through hit records. You know, I was selling out Coliseums all over America long before I ever had a platinum album, and before I even had a gold album, I was doing it. And it was because the band's vibe was good. We went out on stage as friends. Walk out on stage with your buddies, having a good time, just taking the party to the stage, only you just got instruments in your hand. And I really feel like I almost invented that philosophy on stage, and, you know, talking and joking to your guys, and as if, you know, when you're talking to the audience, I would be half the time talking to Bill Church, you know, and the whole audience would be hearing it, you know. It was kind of an intimate thing. My fans have always been, I felt real close to like that, and that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to have a friendly, warm, good time band out there.
The song that first introduced us on his second solo album to Sammy Hagar's affinity for all things Crimson, this high-octane live version of Red, comes from the live album All Night Long, reissued and remastered now. You can find it at Amazon.com. With only the two obscure then Montrose albums and one tour for his brief resume, going it alone in a solo career seemed to be the hardest path that Sammy Hagar could have chosen.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't have a choice. It's really funny, because I didn't want to be a solo artist. I wanted to be the leader of the band. There's no question about that, because I had written so many songs at that stage. I was just writing songs every day. I was really getting prolific. I got so excited about writing those first songs I ever wrote and getting them on a record, and seeing, you know, a band put them together, go on tour, play them on stage, making money from it. I was like going, wow, you know, this is the stuff. So I was really writing a lot. So I wrote just a crap load of songs, and I got a record deal instantly. I was making demos at my house at that stage when I'd be home for a week, man. I'd go down and blast out about five songs with Denny Carmassi on drums, just, you know, rough demos, but still writing my songs, because I was hoping Montrose would do them. But when I got John Carter, heard about me, and obviously was kind of a fan from Capitol Records, he called up and said, you know, I want to sign you. And so I was signed, and I didn't have a band yet. And so I signed to Sammy Hagar. I had a record deal before I had a band.
But when Sammy Hagar did assemble a group to play his songs, what ensued was a grueling period of constant touring, playing a different town every night. The unglamorous life on the road of the opening act. Always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
Oh, man, you got to be kidding. Well, I did 11 months with Boston opening for them, and 9 months opening for Boston. I did two tours like that, so just five shows a week. You know, do your math now, Redbeard. Are those of you listeners, get a paper and a pencil and a calculator. I don't know. I really did tour a lot, and I went out and opened for as many people as I could. I wanted to play every market and get known, and that's after the last show with Boston, the 11-month tour off their second Boston album. I don't even know what year that was. I think it was 78, 79. I released, I think, Danger Zone and maybe Street Machine from Capitol Records with Trans Am. That's what it was. It was Trans Am and all that. I went on tour with Boss. So it was Danger Zone, the next album that I actually went out solo as a headliner. And with the Scorpions opening and Pat Travers playing second, we had a triple bill. And man, we packed every Coliseum in the country. And it was my first headline tour, and it was amazingly successful. And it was just every tour I ever did after that was pretty much a sold out tour. And except for a couple, you know, markets, New York City was real hard for me to break. But you know, eventually, we did well there too.
The title theme to the animated film Heavy Metal. Hard to find, and then Sammy redid it on the album Standing Hampton.
The first version was from the soundtrack, the movie, the animated cartoon film called Heavy Metal, and I wrote that song with Jim Peterik, a guy who was in Survivor and stuff. This is way before he was in Survivor, but he came to my house and we wrote that song, and he was great to work with. I had the riff, you know, kind of a make it last kind of rock candy kind of riff, And we put that song together in about 2 hours. It's amazing. And I recorded it with Roy Thomas Baker, and it came out on the soundtrack. And then I went in the studio to do Standing Hampton about a year later, and Keith Olsen goes, "Oh, I didn't know you wrote that song," and blah, blah, blah. And he said, "Hey, let's put it on this record, too." So I re-recorded it. There's two versions of that song. And the Roy Baker version has a smoking guitar solo. It's one of my best solos ever, I think.
Sammy Hagar. Ooh, love that. Next, Sammy reveals how a key man entered his life who would successfully guide Sammy's career to stardom. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for 35th anniversary of Sammy Hagar's Standing Hampton.
Hey, the Red Rocker Sammy Hagar here in the studio for the Essential Red Collection Part 1. Check it out.
Thanks, Sammy. We're in the studio for the 35th anniversary of Sammy's breakthrough album Standing Hampton in early 1982. For 10 years, Hagar was a journeyman rocker developing an admirable reputation in concert as a blue-collar crowd-pleaser and in the music business as a contender who was missing one elusive element on his recordings.
And when I write a song like One Way to Rock, I do it that style. I crank into amp full blast in my studio, and I jam and scream over the top of it as if there's 50,000 people out there. I wrote that song because rock radio was going through a change at that time. Every time I turned around, it was changing. You know, when I'd release Fall in Love, I'm going to go, "Hey, you know, radio's getting heavier now. You know, they want rock and roll tunes." "Oh, okay, good." And release One Way to Rock, and they're going, "Nah, you know, now they're going back to ballads and acoustic stuff. You know, Fleetwood Mac's big right now, you know." And I'm going, "Man, I'm always missing the boat here." But One Way to Rock, I just got tired of radio stations calling themselves, you know, you go on tour and you hear, you know, The Rock. People say, "Hey, do an ad for us." I say, "Sure." And say, what's your handle here?" "Yeah, we call ourselves The Rock of the South or The Rock of the West, The Rock of the East," blah, blah. And then they'd turn around and they'd play some really smaltzy, folk-type acoustic pop rock or something. I'd say, "Man, these guys call themselves The Rockers. There's only one way to rock. If you're going to call yourself The Rock, then you should rock like this."
From his January 1982 Standing Hampton album, there is only one way to rock with Sammy Hagar. A veteran record man, John Kolodner, with a keen eye and ear for talent, convinced music mogul David Geffen to make Sammy Hagar one of Geffen Records' first signings. The other one was Elton John. The other key event in Sammy's career had happened only slightly earlier, and that was meeting manager Ed Leffler at a Capitol Records private label performance known as the Showcase.
And it was at a place called the Starwood in Los Angeles, and Backstreet Crawler, which is Paul Kossoff, had just quit Free, and guitar player, and he was a heroin addict, and I assume this is what I've heard and so forth, but he was pretty messed up on drugs, and he was opening for Sweet, and Ed Leffler managed Sweet, and they were on Capitol, so everybody was there, and Ed Leffler said, "Oh, I'll go with you down to see this guy you're talking about, Sammy Hagar. Let's go see him." So, I went, and I opened for Paul Kossoff, and tore the place up, man. It was really great. I didn't play many clubs, and when I did, the music was too big for clubs, and it was too powerful, but it made it really happen. In other words, you know, people were going, "Whoa," you know, to the wall, you know. And so we tore it up, and Ed Leffler goes, wow, you know, they introduced me to him, and no big deal. And then the Capitol said, hey, you know, let Sammy open for Sweet at Santa Monica Civic the next weekend. And Leffler goes, I wouldn't let that blonde maniac come before my band for nothing. Are you guys crazy? So is what happened is Paul Kossoff died the next day on an airplane, an overdose or a heart attack or something on his way to San Diego to do the next show. And Ed Leffler said, oh, I guess I'll take Sammy. You know, he was the opening act for Sweet. And oddly enough, I did that show, scored very, very good on that. It was the last time I opened that building as well. I came back and headlined there. And Ed Leffler said, hey, you know, you want to come with me? I said, sure do. So I was impressed with Sweet at that time. They had a big hit, you know, Ballroom Blitz and all that stuff, and Fox on the Run, and they had a great live show. They had video screens, and I thought, boy, this manager, he knows how to make a band look good and this and stuff. So I went with Ed Leffler, and I was with him for 18 years.
Sammy's biggest hit to date was called I'll Fall in Love Again from the 1982 album Standing Hampton. Sammy remembers the inspiration for writing the song.
Genesis had a song, and I don't remember the title of it, and I heard it, and I thought, I really like this part, and I was trying to play the part, not to steal or to rip it. I was just playing a guitar, and I was trying to play their song, and somehow I ended up going, jang, jang, and then I said, oh, this is cool, too. You know, this is different, and it's nothing like the song I was trying to learn, but I'm like that. You know, I'll pick up a guitar, and then you try to play somebody else's song, and you end up writing one instead, and that's wonderful. And when I start trying to write this song, I start thinking, you know, John was coaching me, you know, you need to write more songs with choruses, and because I was more like just a metal riff, a yell and scream over the top of it kind of guy. So, you know, you need better choruses, you know, like Love or Money was a great song. If you had a chorus in it, it would have been a hit, you know, and I'm going, well, okay. So he turned me on to writing a chorus, you know, and so I'll Fall in Love Again was almost one of my first attempts at writing a chorus, you know, that. It was my first kind of hit on Geffen. It wasn't that big of a hit, but it was a hit for me in a lot of ways. In Texas, a place like that, it was a hit. And if I remember right, people like you played that song a lot.
Next, Sammy fesses up about the Standing Hampton title and charts his success as a stadium filler. I'm Redbeard. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. You're in the studio with Sammy Hagar, 35th anniversary of his breakthrough album, Standing Hampton.
Hey, the Red Rocker Sammy Hagar here in the studio for the Essential Red Collection Part 1. Check it out.
Thanks again, Sammy. Okay, buddy, what up with the album title Standing Hampton and that surrealistic cover art with the babe and the buff?
Stand here. What? How am I going to get out of this, Redbird? You're going to get me in trouble here. You're not going to play it if I say what really it really means. So, Standing Hampton. So I thought, that's a great, funny title. It's Cockney rhyme. A Hampton is a... And standing, of course, as you all would know, would be an erection. So a Standing Hampton is a Cockney rhyme, British term for a hard-on. Look at the cover. Now you get the cover. Actually, now that the people really know that, then when they see the cover, then they'll get the cover art. The guy's got his hat over it. It ain't me on the cover, though, folks. It wouldn't fit.
The follow-up to Standing Hampton was called Three Lock Box in late 82, featuring a number 13 hit, Your Love is Driving Me Crazy. Crucial in his career development all through that time was Hagar's performance at the annual Texas Jam, a series of huge, multi-group outdoor summer rock festivals in the Dallas Cotton Bowl Stadium.
Those events, Texas Jam, were when I was first starting out, the first time I opened the Texas Jam for 70,000 people or whatever, I came out and did really good. The people just, you know, they were in the mood, man. First band out, you know, and I came out, tore it up, and made a reputation for myself in all of Texas and even going as far as Oklahoma City and the surrounding states. Became, you know, Sammy Hagar favorites because I was always at the jam and I was always promoting the jams. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever done. The first time I played a big show like that, I mean, I was dying. I'm going, this is the greatest thing could ever be. This is all I want to do, you know, is play these big shows. I felt like I could connect with those 75, 80,000 people on stage. And it worked for me because that's the only state in America that I'd play 11 shows was in the state of Texas. And I could play any town that had anywhere from 8 to 20,000 seat place and sell it out, you know, And that was early on in my career. And I know it was because of the jams. So many people had seen me, and it was like I was a household name there. And before anywhere else as far as the whole state goes. But now, then you got St. Louis, where I got to play on a stadium show there, same thing, and it worked for me there too. And that became St. Louis, and just that city though. I used to play St. Louis and do two nights at the Checker Dome, yeah. About two nights, about 35,000 people, and go about 400 miles down the road to about 3,500 people. It was amazing, just a phenomenon that happened there. And I attribute those kind of things to the big shows, because those were the cities, happened for me in San Francisco as well. They used to have Day on the Green there. And I played three or four of those, worked up to the headliner as well. And the same thing, San Francisco has always been a huge city for me. And the places where I got to play those big outdoor shows, they seemed to be the markets where the first ones to where I became big, to where I do multiple nights in the Coliseums. And I still love playing stadium shows more than anything. They're my favorite things to do. Suckers walk, money talks, but it can't touch my three-lock box. I love that intro, man. I think I kind of capitalized. I can't say I invented, because Black Dog, Led Zeppelin, had the first song that I remember that started with the singing. You know, hey, mama, say the way, mama. I kind of stole that with Love or Money and did it with Relock Box and did it with High Hopes. And there's been a couple other ones, I think. I like those songs that start off with a vocal. You kind of get your point right straight off, right? You know, let's get something. It's like, yeah, let's get something straight here, okay? Whap!
This is Redbeard in the studio. I'll be back after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my buddy, Sammy Hager. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2017. All rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.